Perfect. And so both counsel, you will have 15 minutes for your opening, your primary argument, and then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. You can take your time getting situated at the podium. It does adjust up and down. There's a button sort of right below the podium where you can adjust it. And I'll ask the marshal to call the case.
A240174, Dillavu versus Sirwa.
Thank you. And so if you could please, this will be recorded, so please state your name and who you represent for the record. And when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel. I'm Lee Novelli, and I represent the appellant, Michelle Dillavu. There are two primary issues on appeal. The first is whether the district court erroneously treated appellant's request.
Can you talk up just a little bit?
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Maybe. You could pull the microphone closer to you. Yeah.
There we go. Is that better?
Yeah.
I'll do my best. I'm not the loudest of speakers.
I don't know which way is that. Okay, thank you.
Two primary issues on appeal. The first is whether the district court erroneously treated appellant's request to modify parenting time and modify provisions of the parenting plan as a motion to modify custody pursuant to 518.18d. The second is whether the district court made findings of fact that were unsupported by the record, by the evidence in the record, and made inadequate findings regarding the minor child's best interests. The primary error is the application of 518.18d. The district court, in finding of fact 3, finds that the parenting plan established parenting time in an equal 5-2-2-5 schedule, which is de facto joint physical custody. And then later in conclusion of law 3, finds that the evidence, that appellant's argument does strike the court as a de facto motion to modify physical custody, and then does an analysis under 518.18d of appellant's request to modify parenting time as a request to modify custody. Now, there's no dispute in this case that the parties did not agree on custody labels. There is no order for custody. They instead agreed on a parenting plan, and that parenting plan did not specify the child's primary residence.
Parenting plan did specify that you can't move permanent residence within 25 miles of the airport or 15 miles outside of North Scott County.
It did provide restrictions on the parents' residence, I would agree, but it doesn't assign primary residence of where, between the parties, of where the child is to reside. That's a specific legal designation that this parenting plan does not provide. What this parenting plan provided was restrictions on location.
But wasn't where, that part of it because of the nesting, child stays in place, part of this plan?
The parties did agree. They rented an apartment in, I can't remember where it was, but in Minnesota, and agreed that they were going to nest for a while until they each made appropriate housing arrangements.
But at the time the parenting plan was made, that's what I took from the record, was that part of the reason that there wasn't a specific designated primary residence was because each parent would stay in the residence with the child when they were exercising parenting time, and then the other parent would come in.
That was actually that was intended, I think it's clear from the language in the parenting plan, that was a short-term arrangement while they transitioned to Minnesota. That I don't think that can be considered a primary residence designation. I think that was a stopgap to transition them from one state to another.
Wouldn't the request to move to St. Peter be a modification of that parenting plan, though, because it would move mother outside of those location limitations?
Absolutely. I mean, mother made, in my opinion, 3 requests to modify provisions of the parenting plan. Parenting time, I mean, that would also be a modification of the parenting plan. The residence restrictions for the parents, and then the child's school. Those 3 were needed if she and the child were to relocate to St. Peter. I think those were part of mother's requests. But 518.18d, by its plain language, states that the court shall not modify a prior custody order or a parenting plan provision which specifies the child's primary residence unless, and then it goes on to detail how those changes are to be made. Neither, there was no award of custody. There is no custody order pursuant to 518.18d in this case. There is no parenting plan provision specifying the child's primary residence. So 518.18d, it just simply doesn't apply. Now, the court, in applying that statute, relies on In Re MJH or Christensen v. Healy. And in that case, it's easily distinguishable because in that case, the mother was awarded sole physical custody. And what the court found is that the father's request to increase his parenting time from 21% to 50% was, in my opinion, a backdoor modification of physical custody. Because of the 518.003 definition of physical custody as structuring care and control of the child between the homes, the court found that such a significant modification of parenting time undermined that order for mom to have sole physical custody.
Is the term primary residence as used in 518.18d, is that a defined term that you're aware of elsewhere in the statute?
No, it is not defined by statute. There is some relatively vague language in case law providing some details regarding primary residence, but in my experience, primary residence is allocated when the parties use those terms in their court orders.
But in effect, would we have to be defining, to agree with you, define primary residence as a specific single address as opposed to, you know, you can construe the parenting plan, I think, to Judge Schmidt's point, as defining a primary residence for the child within a geographic boundary. You know, after moving to either Shakopee, Savage, or Prior Lake, the parties agree not to move the child's residence on a permanent basis more than 15 miles from the areas noted therein.
I think the designation of primary residence in custody and parenting time cases is typically between the parents. Mother has primary residence of the child, particularly in some cases for school purposes. Or primary residence of the child is with this parent, even though we allocate joint physical custody. Primary residence is not typically locale specific. I've never seen that definition applied to that term. It's when you're trying to distinguish who the child will live with primarily, usually for school purposes or sometimes for if a parent is living out of state or something. So I don't believe that the residential restrictions on the parents' residences that they mutually agreed upon would be considered a primary residence designation.
So on this question of primary residence, is it your position that they're under the parenting plan, there is no primary residence? I mean, it's 50-50 time. But isn't your client asking to become the primary resident of the child post-move to St. Peter?
Well, I don't think she's not asking for a primary residence designation.
But wouldn't that be... I mean, isn't that the impact of it?
I think the impact is a modification. I think these parties, in deciding, you know, the statutes in Minnesota and in Colorado allow parents to opt out of these designations, to opt out of custody
and
primary residence designations. And that's what these parties chose to do. Now, they did structure parenting time.
But there's no explicit statement in the parenting plan saying these do not apply to us, these terms. I mean, this was, right? I mean, it doesn't say...
It doesn't say the word, I don't believe...
Explicitly, your brief does say they expressly did that, but it's not express. You're saying the impact of it because those words aren't used in the... parenting plan,
I'm saying that they chose to do a parenting plan that did not include custodial designations or primary residence designations. They could have chosen to do either of those things.
Well, I don't know Colorado law, so I don't know that. All I know is what's in it, and now we're in Minnesota, and we have to apply Minnesota law.
But what we do know is that they were both represented by counsel. They knew that
I'm not questioning, any of that.
Well, and at the time they signed the parenting plan, they knew they were moving to Minnesota.
So they could have.
They absolutely could. I mean, there's a lot they could have done. Lots of,
But your client registered this as a custodial plan in Minnesota courts, right?
She did in May of 2022, I believe.
So you're saying your position is that under the provisions of this parenting plan, that no matter what mom proposed, that the only standard would be best interest of the child. We would never get into, was there a change of circumstances? Was there integration? Was there endangerment? We never get into that, no matter what mom's proposing. If she said, I want a change in parenting time such that dad, spends one day every 6 months with the child, you would still say, is that in the best interest of the child? And that's it under Minnesota law, that she would never de facto become the primary resident.
I think that is the result of the party's decision to do a parenting plan.
Allows a party to opt out of our state's laws?
No,
we're governed by the statute. That's where I'm having the biggest issue with your argument.
I don't think she's opting. I absolutely do not think she's opting out of Minnesota law. I think what they decided to craft was a parenting plan, which is governed by modifications of parenting plan are governed by Minnesota law. They're just not governed by Minnesota 518.18d. Minnesota 518.18d very specifically says when it applies. This case has to be applied 518.175 subdivision 5 B and C. That's the law that Judge Lennon should have applied. And that
parties, and I'm sorry, I should know this, and I've read the actual agreement, but I can't remember offhand now. Did they designate the standard of review that it should be governed by best interests or shouldn't as a parenting plan?
Their parenting plan.
So then that's allowed under Minnesota law.
Yeah,
not what these parties chose.
It's not required under Minnesota law.
Yeah.
And lots of, I write parenting plans all the time a lot of parenting plans don't choose to do that. And it's not unheard. I mean, for these parties, essentially what you're saying, I would be more sympathetic to your argument if these parties didn't know that they were going to end up in Minnesota. Then I think I would find that argument perhaps slightly more compelling. But either way, they chose not to do custody designations. Colorado has custody designations, I'm certain. And they chose not to do a primary residence designation. And so this parenting plan is modifiable that's what they chose, and the statute that applies is 518.175, which is the best interest of the child.
Well, according to your argument. Okay.
The Supreme Court and MJH in finding that you can't do this backdoor modification of physical custody, basically said that the parties are bound by the custody labels they've chosen. And I think the same applies in this case. The parties are bound by the decisions that they made of what to include in that parenting plan and what not to include. And I think the court has to honor that, even if that results in, rather than an endangerment or an integration standard, a best interest standard. Minnesota also allows parties to opt for a best interest analysis even when other provisions of 518.18d would be triggered. Or would not be triggered, excuse me. And so it's not unheard of to do a best interest analysis in situations involving significant modifications of parenting time if the parties agree. And I think this is another way that parties agree to use that lower standard. And I think that this court has to honor that agreement that the parties made.
What do you make of 518.1705 subdivision 4? Which under paragraph C says that if the parties don't agree to apply the best interest standard, section 518.18 paragraph D applies.
I'm sorry, do you mind repeating that?
So as I understand it, 518.1705 subdivision 2C notes that parents can voluntarily agreeing to parenting plans may substitute other terms for physical and legal custody, including designations of joint or sole custody, provided that the terms used in the substitution are defined in the parenting plan. And then under subdivision 4, it's subdivision 9, C, it goes on to say, if the parties do not agree in the parenting plan to apply the best interest standard, then 518.1A paragraph D applies.
I think that, I don't think that you can back into an endangerment analysis without, again, I mean, 518.18 only triggers when these two situations occur, a custody order or a primary residence designation. They chose not to do that. So I think the court has to apply the only statute that is in existence to modify provisions of a parenting plan. I don't think that that provision trumps the court's, the only statute that allows modification of provisions of a parenting plan, if 518.18 doesn't trigger. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, please finish the answer.
I don't think that the court can apply 518.18 if the plain language of 518 doesn't allow for it, which it doesn't. Thank you.
I have one more question, if I may. So if we do look at the best interests, the district court did do some best interest analysis in paragraphs 6, 7, 8 of its order. Why would that not be enough for us to affirm the district court?
I just want to look at the paragraphs you referenced. Actually, you know, in paragraph 6, the court notes that it has authority to modify the provisions of the parenting plan. And then it makes one sentence and then it goes on to talk about restrictions under the Neustrand v. Arend case. So there's no findings in paragraph 6 other than the sentence that allows it authority. There are no findings analyzing best interest factors. In paragraph 7, it makes one sentence, it's not in Ben's best interest for mother to restrict father's parenting time and move. That's literally one of the only references to the words best interest. And then it talks for the rest of the paragraph about how it is not viable to modify that provision of the parenting plan because the parenting plan doesn't permit it. So it says, I'm allowed to modify provisions of the parenting plan, but I can't change the residential restrictions because the parenting plan doesn't allow it. There is actually, in my opinion, no analysis of the best interests in that paragraph. It's simply the court talking about what the residential restriction was, and that it literally says that the mother's request to allow the move is denied on the grounds it violates the prior established PPP. That's not a best interest analysis. Now, paragraph 8, I think, gets closest to a best interest analysis. The court talks about mother's concerns about consistency and stability and depriving the minor child of that, and then talks about, it makes a finding that restricting one side of this relationship could seriously impact Ben's growth and development. What I find very concerning in this analysis, and I think this is really the only section you could pull out that does anything close to a best interest analysis, is that it doesn't actually talk about the impact on Ben resulting from dad absenting himself from Ben's life at the level that he did. I mean, if you look at from July of 2021 when they moved here to, I think it was July of 2023, so a two-year period. Now, during that period, there were 4.5 months in the beginning where he was stepping up his parenting. So he was, if you look at the timeline, he was supposed to have an equal parenting time schedule by the middle of November 2021. And so if you just look at parenting time from December of 2021 until when the pleadings were submitted in July, dad had, on average, 9 overnights a month. And so that's, I mean, these, you know, talk about the impact of restricting that side of the relationship. Dad was doing that himself. That's the entire reason why mom filed this motion, is because he wasn't doing what the parties intended. He wasn't stepping up and being an equal co-parent, and she needed more assistance, and she was trying to get that assistance by relocating closer to her family because Dad wasn't doing what the parties needed him to do and honestly what Ben needed him to do.
All right. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you for the additional time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, when you are ready, please state your name and who you represent for the record, and you may proceed.
Yes, may it please the court and counsel. My name is Lori Mack Wagner, representing Alex Sirwa, who is the father in this matter. The court properly denied this motion four different ways, in our view. The first way was under 518.18d, and I understand that the court was focusing a lot on this, so I'm going to focus my attention on that. It is our position that while people are entitled to call whatever they want to call their arrangement, you know, remove the labels or remove the confines of joint legal, sole physical, and primary residence, 518.1705 subdivision 9 definitely says that if you are going to modify parenting time under that section and you want something other than the endangerment standard, then you need to clearly waive it. And I think the reason for that is one of the questions was, what does it matter what mom asks? I think really what we're saying here is that if we're taking mother's argument, these people are in no man's land. They're not governed by our laws. They don't have the protections that everyone else does.
Well, no. I mean, you can bring a motion for a change in parenting time without proving endangerment or integration, correct? It only arises if this is a de facto motion for custody.
Right.
And So I've got a question for you, though.
Okay.
So Dad bought a house in South Minneapolis, not in the... whatever school district Dale is in, the elementary school that the child was attending, correct? Why is the burden on mom to keep an apartment in Savage so that the child can continue to attend that school? That seems fundamentally unfair to me.
No, just to be clear on the record, the purchase of the house was within the agreed parameters.
Right, but then all of a sudden to keep the child in the same school, the burden is 100% on the mother, which doesn't seem fair to me.
The agreement does not require the child to stay in that school. The agreement requires the child to stay within a school within 25 minutes of the airport. And so that was one of the dad's arguments of why he didn't want to go to St. Peter, because if the school is not working out, there are more resources within the zone that the parties picked for the school. So, mom, I think the bigger problem is not so much the school choice. It's really that mom wants to move 70 miles away. And, you know, the whole premise of dad, the agreement was based on workability because dad's job is in Colorado. He flies in, the school's near the airport, the location restrictions for the parents' residences are agreed upon by them, and he follows
it. How can he be enrolled in the best Northern Scott County if neither parent lives in Northern Scott County? And that is in the agreement, right? The best public school available in that part of the county.
Well, I think the issue here is that mom is not asking to be in any kind of school that is in 25 minutes from the airport. She's asking to be in a school that's 70 miles away. So I think that's the real concern, is that the changes that mom is asking for.
But that's what concerned the district court. I mean, the district court said if mother leaves her Savage apartment, the parties lose the ability to enroll Ben in the public school district of Prior Lake Savage.
And again, I think if it was just a simple school choice discussion, keeping within the location discussion or the location parameter that was agreed upon by them, 25 minutes from the airport, that opens up a lot of schools. Unfortunately, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about moving the child away from a parent, cutting a parent's parenting time from 50% down to every other weekend and a 10-day period where he doesn't see the child doesn't see his father. I mean, unfortunately, that's what we're talking about. And that is considered a drastic reduction under Minnesota law. That is considered to be restricting parenting time.
That as a practical matter, I mean, for good reason, that, you know, father has a job. It's in Colorado. He has to travel, you know, to at least part of the time to be in Colorado, that he wasn't able, is not able to exercise his full parenting time. Well, so what's the response to that? Is it really such a big change? Shouldn't this just be viewed? I mean, setting aside the move to St. Peter, because it all gets intertwined.
Yeah, so one of the things that's really important to know is an important fact is that we heard council say that it took 4.5 months to get the schedule up to the 50-50 or to transition to that. Mother bought her house in St. Peter, within six months of moving here. So,
yeah, it sounds it's like not they like, both made decisions one way or the other.
Okay.
So let's not focus on that. Let's focus on the question was about parenting time. So let's focus on the relevant issue.
So I think part of there was context put into the affidavits where it said that it took longer for him to be able to switch to virtual than he had wanted. There was a delay in getting started. And then in the months leading up to the motion, he was able to do almost a 50-50. And that's where the court was looking at it and the context of his allegations. And, you know, basically did look at this as a substantial restriction on his parenting time. And when mother was doing her averages, she's including the agreed period of time where father was like ramping up, you know, to the 50-50 schedule.
Can I ask you a follow-up question on the chief's questions about the school issue? I mean, mother's motion was included a request for an order that the child be enrolled in school in St. Peter, right? I mean, that was part of what she was asking for. It was to take the child out of the Glendale school in Scott County and enroll the child in St. Peter. So, I mean, this, I definitely think it's troubling as well, the idea that the burden would be on the mother to maintain the Savage apartment to keep the child in the Prior Lake Savage School District. But, I mean, should we be looking at that as, was the district court inartful in putting it that way? I mean, if the district court ruled in mother's favor on the motion, the district court would have been granting mother's request to take the child out of Prior Lake Savage and enroll the child in St. Peter, which was definitely not contemplated by the original parenting plan, right?
Yeah, I think the district court, like, properly looked at it both ways, looked at it both from the endangerment standard and also the best interest standard. And if people want to do a change in school, that's a best interest analysis, if that's all you're really talking about. The problem is when this required along with it a complete reduction in the parenting time, which then triggers all kinds of restrictions on parenting time and whether you've met the endangerment standard to do that. And it wasn't simply a motion on school choice. It was a whole change of life, changing the routine care and control. And I think what the court did is looked at it, first of all, yes, I know we don't have definitions in here, but they're doing equal parenting time, and they've agreed in writing that it's going to be joint decision-making when it comes to living arrangements and it comes to the care and control of the child. So I don't know how else to call this other than joint. And so if I'm seeing someone in here with a motion that wants to change, actually set the residence somewhere completely different than the area they agreed in or the arrangement between the parties, which was 50-50, that's a big change. And I think the court does go on to do the best interest analysis as well and say, even if I'm not looking at the endangerment, I am looking at the best interest. And under the law, the law does not require the court to go through every factor. But the court does say, I don't think this is in the best interest of the minor child, and the court does talk about the affidavits, does talk about the parents describing their routines with the child and how the court is concerned that those would be disrupted, particularly with regard to the father, if this request was granted. And, you know, under the law, the court can sufficiently say that without having to go through every detail of what mom asked for in evaluating each point. I think if one reads the decision, the takeaway is that the court was worried about the impact on the relationship between this child and the father if this were to happen. And I think that that's, you know, the concern. And if the parties had designated clearly joint legal, joint physical, this kind of move and this kind of request unquestionably would have counted as a de facto modification.
If I could interrupt for a minute. So with regard to labels, what is your position, I guess, that under just the PPP, not under any of the facts or the nesting period, I mean, do you read that as that there is no primary residence at that point because there's 50, it's a 5-2-2-5, 50-50 time-sharing arrangement? Was there primary residence? And then how do we define that term if you're contending that it would make mom's house the primary residence if the court had agreed?
I read it as the designation was for equal parenting time and that decisions regarding the living arrangements of the child are to be made jointly. I view it as mom's request to make her house the main house of the child as a request to become the primary resident, which is a modification of primary residence, because I don't see how else you could do that. I think that's one of the safeguards that the parenting plan statute has for those parents that want to operate without designations, is to say, if you're going to change your standard that protects you from drastic modifications, you need to do it knowingly and openly, that you're saying all that's going to be required to make drastic changes is best interest.
But the issue under the statute, it's not whether or not the change is a new primary residence, it's whether the existing parenting plan has specified that there is a primary residence, right? I mean, that's the issue. So, because that's how the language of the statute reads, right? So if there isn't, I mean, I think that's what I understand your counterpart's argument to be, is because the parenting plan didn't specify a primary residence, then 518.18d doesn't apply. So, I mean, you can, then we don't have to follow that statute.
Yeah, I just think that becomes a problem with the 518.1705 subdivision 9. Why have that provision? Because the whole statutory scheme allows people to do that. So it allows them to have no designations, at least on the primary resident front. And it says you can define it how you would like. You just have to be clear on your definition. But then it does have that part in the bottom, like that says if you're going to change it for modification, you have these protections.
Or do we have to, like I asked your counterpart earlier, do we have to define primary residence as including a geographic designation, as it was in this situation? I think they go back to Judge Schmidt's question at the beginning.
I think it's an interesting question because there is no statutory definition of it, that I think it is somewhat open to interpretation how you want to do that. I think people traditionally look at it as what is the primary resident as between the two parents, and in here we've got an equal parenting schedule and nothing specified, except they're going to jointly decide living arrangements.
What does primary residence mean when it's equal parenting time? What exactly does it mean in those situations, other than just being a label that this is the child's primary residence?
I'm not aware of any law that really says what that means. I think that, you know, what we see when we do these decrees, sometimes we'll say they both equally have parenting time, but then we'll use this person's, you know, address for school purposes. But I just think that in this case, you've got a situation where the designation is equal.
So I've got, if I have one more question, and that is about procedure. It seems you've argued in your brief that this is, the court was right to apply Christensen v. Healy, that this is a motion for a de facto change in custody, correct? Modification, correct?
Yes, if that particular statute applies, if the court determines that, then I would say yes, because of the nature of the change that the mother is asking to make, which changes the everyday routine custody and control, and under the totality of the circumstances, the change in the school, the change in the care, the change in the routine control over the schedule of the child and how it's structured would be substantially altered.
So one thing that I had trouble getting my mind around is that the court's order is based on affidavits. There was no evidentiary hearing. Shouldn't there have been an evidentiary hearing here? I mean, the typical process is the district court makes a decision whether a prima facie case has been made out to support a motion for a modification of custody. Then there's an evidentiary hearing. But it seems like, and I don't know that either party asked for that, which I guess is another question. Because if neither party asked for it, you know, that maybe that answers why it was resolved the way it was.
Oh, I think I'm out of time. Do you want me to answer this?
Yes,
wait.
Please.
Oh, okay.
Please go ahead and answer this.
Okay. So I think, so I said there are four ways that I think the court properly denied the motion. I think three of those would require an evidentiary hearing. The best interest doesn't require it if you can proceed on affidavits.
So that would apply if it's just a modification of parenting time, correct?
Right.
Right.
So if it really is the best interest standard, then we don't require the evidentiary hearing. So then if there's an actual modification under the higher standards of endangerment and integration, the court has to look at, if I believe everything that you say is true and I put in context some things that the other side has said, do I think what you said really is enough to really warrant a trial? And in this case, the court did that and said, I'm looking at your allegations of an endangerment, which has not been appealed, and said, no, you don't, on the surface of it, make the case. And then on endangerment, which has been appealed, said, I'm looking at your calculations. I don't think that they're enough just in what you're saying.
But aren't you supposed to look just at mother's allegations then to see if there's a prima facie case made out? I mean, it seems like we're kind of in this between world. And honestly, did either side, as far as you recall, ask for an evidentiary hearing? Because that's a whole nother question then.
I believe that my client probably did, if there was no prima facie, or if the prima facie case was granted, then that I would have to check that. But I think that that's the case. I don't think the
mother
side
asked for, well, but, and the mother has rebuttal, so can, yeah.
But it's just our position that the court, although the court has to accept the moving party's allegations as true, it specifically said, I'm looking at what you gave me, and I don't see it as being.
So you would take the court's order here as essentially saying there's no prima facie case.
Correct.
Okay.
And then the fourth one, because those are one and two, and then the fourth one that we didn't talk about was if you have parenting time and you want to substantially restrict someone's parenting time, you have to show endangerment, and that requires a trial. And then you have to make the allegations that it's there's enough endangerment shown to warrant a trial. And again, I think the court was clearly saying you didn't make a finding on endangerment, and I think that would apply on ways number one, which was the endangerment for the custody change, and way number four, which was parenting time and the restrictions and what's required for that.
Can I ask one?
Yeah.
Sorry. Is it right that then, weirdly, if we agreed with appellant and the best interest standard applied, then there wouldn't have been no need for an evidentiary hearing, and it could have just been decided on the affidavits anyway. And if we think that the district court did enough in its best interest analysis, we could affirm that way.
Correct.
Without remanding for an evidentiary hearing.
Correct.
I had one more question for you, too. So this is back to the chief's concern expressed earlier about putting the burden primarily on mother. So it appears to me on the relocation, the parties agreed that they were going to move to Shakopee or Prior Lake. And then they said, but not move more than 15 miles outside that area. So they had two cities that they particularly specified. Is there anything in the record that shows the father got prior written consent or approval from mother or approval from the court to move to Minneapolis?
No, the only thing in the record is that his choice falls within the agreed parameters.
Well, it falls within the 15 miles, but it's not one of the two cities that after the parties moved it. Did father move to Shakopee or Prior Lake?
I think there's a provision in the PPP that says after that initial move, the moves have to be within 15 miles. So I think this is referring to the later move, not the initial move. They both moved there and did the nesting.
I understand. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, when you are ready, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to return to Your Honor's question about 518.1705, the parenting plan, subdivision 9. What that provision actually does is it confirms that 518.18d is applicable if you're going to modify the primary residence of the child. And it puts even a greater restriction that if you're going to modify the primary residence and you want to use a different standard than 518.18d, you have to do special things. So it doesn't say that 518.18d applies. It says the same thing that 518.18d says, which is we're going to apply 518.18d if you change the child's primary residence designation in a parenting plan. And if you don't want that application, you have to do all these special things. You have to sign special things. So that says the same thing that I was arguing, which is that provision does not apply 518.18d unless there's been a modification of the primary residence designation.
You're talking about subdivision B, where it says that would change the child's primary residence?
That's correct. Well, I mean, subdivision A says, at the end, it says the time limits provided by 518.18d are applied in a motion to modify decision-making provisions. And then later in B, it says basically 518.18d applies if you're going to modify the primary residence designation in a parenting plan. And if you don't want that applied, then you have to do these special things. So, I mean, if there is no primary residence designation,
Sorry, my hand waving was not reacting to anything you said. Although I saw you taken aback. I was just reading the paragraph 19.
So I was just going to say, it is slightly different, though, right? I mean, the other way you can read this is actually more generous to your counterpart, because instead of saying does not specify primary residence in B, it says modification that would change the child's primary residence. So if we were strictly reading D in the way you want, we would say the PPP doesn't specify a primary residence, so it does. 518.18d doesn't apply. But if we're reading 518.1705 harmoniously with 518.18, I mean, it seems like this is broader. It's a motion for modification that would change the child's primary residence. So if we thought that the geographic designation was effectively a primary residence, then it would seem to me that once we get down to C, we would have to. I mean, the district court would have to apply 518.18d, right?
I think if this court finds that the residential restrictions on where the parties are going to live is a primary residence designation, which I think is a bit of a stretch, but if this court does, then I think 518.18d applies.
Oh, you're right. Okay.
Right? So, I mean, I think this says the same thing that 518d says and makes it harder to not apply 518d when there's a primary residence designation.
Can I ask a question that the chief had asked? Did your client ask for an evidentiary hearing?
No, you don't. My understanding is when 518-18D applies, neither party is required to request an evidentiary hearing. If the court finds that a prima facie showing of any of the factors is made, then it results in an evidentiary hearing. That's most common in my experience in the case law in endangerment cases, but I think it would also apply to integration cases. I think it's applied generally to 518-18D. If a prima facie showing is made, it goes to an evidentiary hearing.
And would you agree with your opponent that we should construe the district court's order as there was no prima facie case made?
I think if this court finds that 518-18D applies, then it should, in my opinion, it should have resulted in an evidentiary hearing because my client made the district court did not rely on the appellant's affidavit in analyzing the prima facie showing. In conclusion of law 5 is very clear. The court makes a finding that is incorrect, I mean, is not supported by the evidence, that the parties followed an approximately equal parenting time schedule in the year leading up to the hearing. That is, the evidence presented by appellant is that he was exercising 30% parenting time. So there's no way to read that except as error by the court. And so I think that would have, if the court had properly taken appellant's arguments regarding the parenting time schedule into account, it would have triggered an integration, a hearing to assess the integration arguments she was making under 518-18D. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for the arguments today and the briefs that you submitted. It was well argued and well briefed. We will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame. And that is our last case for the day, so we are adjourned.
All rise.